everybody, and a welcome back to another season of Hooked on Hitchcock. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I've got my co-host here, as always. How are you doing, G. Larry Butler?
Howdy, howdy. I'm hooked all the way.
Yes, you are.
Daughter with me, Bonnie Butler.
Yes. We have a special guest. How are you doing, Bonnie?
I'm doing good. How are you, Jonathan?
Good. Now, this is your first time on this show, right?
No, I've been here before.
You've been on this one, on Hooked on Hitchcock?
No.
I don't think you're on Hooked on Hitchcock. You've been on the Indie Film Cafe twice.
Yeah.
But yeah, you haven't been on this one particularly yet. But we are very happy to have you. In fact, it was my suggestion, since this was, you know, a very nice movie to watch, you know, like this is not something bad or anything. We've had that problem before. So
with Paul.
Yes, this is not rated R or anything. It was very tame, and I don't know, it was very fun. I really enjoyed this movie, and I know it was originally on a Criterion release on like DVD, but it hasn't gotten a Blu-ray release yet, and that's kind of makes me sad because I want it on Blu-ray because it's beautifully filmed. You know, there's so many great shots and everything in it. Would you agree, Larry?
Totally agree, yeah. And well, I appreciated the psychoanalytical element because I was a psychologist for a while in graduate school. But and we'll talk about that later. So I can appreciate some of the nuances in this, whereas a lot of people probably would gloss over it because they didn't get the inside, not joke necessarily, but some of the inside, I can't even think of a word right now, but some of the inside words and expressions and kind of innuendos. And anyway, I want to let you talk about the plot and everything. And
okay. So I guess to begin with, it starts with you meet the main woman. Well, actually, before then, you sort of meet other characters inside the place, you know, if I'm correct. What's it called? Like Green Meadows or something? Green Manor.
Yeah, it's a what the hell you call it? It's a mental asylum for mentally disturbed people, and it was fascinating to see this because I know Kurt Vonnegut wrote about the inmates took over the asylum. Remember, I don't know if you remember Vonnegut, but he wrote a story about how they revolted and took over, either killed or just tied up the actual staff, and then they became the staff. So then when the governor came to visit, he thought he was dealing with the staff and they were the inmates and they were acting like the staff. So that's pretty, and I think Hitchcock borrowed from that. And
probably
the whole thing arises from a new concept called psychoanalysis that was really big in the 40s. And it was championed by a producer, David O. Selznick.
Mm-hmm.
He actually had his own psychologist on staff to advise him on the movie. And probably needed it because he clashed with Hitchcock. Hitchcock had a lot of neuroses. And so anyway, he wanted to advocate it to the world. That's why this film was even made, because he put up the money for Hitchcock to direct it. So that's what happened.
Well, if I'm correct, basically David Selznick brought Hitchcock over originally to make Hollywood films. So the first one being the film Rebecca. And at that time when he was doing Rebecca, was the middle of, I believe, like Gone with the Wind or one of those other projects. And Selznick was not around, you know, because he was too busy with the other project. So that gave Alfred Hitchcock like free rein to do what he wanted to do. And then when he did other films for Selznick was a little bit more hands-on and a little bit more like, I don't want you doing this or doing that.
They clashed over casting. They clashed over Salvador Dali's sequence.
I know. The one thing about the casting, they originally wanted, I think Hitchcock's original want was Cary Grant for the main role. And honestly, I don't see that.
Well, that was, well, maybe, but according to my notes, if I can find them, he wanted two other people, actually. He wanted to bring Greta Garbo out of retirement, and then he wanted Joseph Cotten as the lead. But for some reason, they were not available or didn't want to do it, and so that they passed. And I'm kind of glad they did, because I couldn't see them as being, you know, a couple, you know, in a romance. But anyway, yeah. So that's what happened. And later, Cotten went on to do the radio show
version of this. Yeah,
he did it in 48 and again in 51. So he got his shot at it,
which was nice. I mean, because like then, you know, that's really cool, because then Hitchcock got his original thing, you know, but it's in a different format and everything. So that's pretty cool. And did you know that the original title that Hitchcock wanted for this was Hidden Impulse?
In what?
It was after Alfred Hitchcock had suggested Hidden Impulse as a title, studio secretary Ruth Rickman came up with the title Spellbound, which tested well in a pre-release survey.
Now, I wonder if the audience knows what Spellbound means. We don't use it much today. That means when you're totally infatuated or engrossed in whatever it is, a thing or a person, and you can't think of anything else, you become obsessed almost. And they pull you in. You're in a spell. You know, it's like witchcraft.
It worked really well, like with this movie, because in a way, she was very spellbound with this guy who she couldn't, you know, which to the point where her like professor guy that she knew, her doctor that she worked under and everything, he kept kind of telling her, you know, be careful, you're falling too hard for this patient, you know, and you can't see that he might actually be a murderer.
That was my sole complaint in the whole movie. It went too fast. I think Hitchcock normally goes in a slow
growth. Oh, no. Remember, we've seen films where Suspicion, the first one we did, Cary Grant and the girl just get married like in a day, you know.
That doesn't do it for me. I need more of a resistance to his charms. I mean, when they first looked at each other, it was like love at first sight. You could see mm-hmm. it.
It was the first time she saw him come out of the car or whatever. She fell in love with him, you know.
Realistic to me, but maybe that some people do that. So A Stranger on a Train was better because she resisted him till the end of the movie. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
It was really cruel to him, actually. But Bonnie, what did you think of this whole movie? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I think it was different from some of the stuff I've seen.
I mean, as a young person, you probably have different, you know, perception mm-hmm. of things like this. She was a little surprised about how men were treating women. Talk to them about that.
Well, yeah, I'm totally against the fact that, you know, men treat women, you know, bad and what? Yeah. Oh, and yeah, so I just think it's just surprising that, I don't know. It's just weird to me that that you would put that in the film, but you know, back then men were like that, so yeah. I guess I understand that.
Yeah. Well, they shouldn't have been, but yes, they were very much like that. And things have changed. You can't remake Spellbound today without cutting all of that stuff out. If you're going to update it to like the times of today, nobody would speak like that and treat women the way they did. So yeah,
the general mentality of the entire planet, well, in America anyway, how men treated women like objects, and they're not equal, and they're a piece of furniture, and you know, and he even said at one point, You know, there's nothing worse than a smug woman, right?
Right.
You know, it's like, God, these are so scornful. If when they weren't hitting on you, they were insulting you if you're a woman.
Yeah, and they were sort of, and the women sort of took it very, very nicely back then, I guess, or at least she did. I was surprised at some of the responses that, like, I would have thought, like, today, if somebody said that to you, you would punch them or, you know, slap them or whatever, you know? It's not appropriate.
Right.
But I just, like, the first half of the film, it was going fine, you know, no insults toward women or anything. But then it suddenly, you know.
Well, how about the older men? How about the older men?
Well, I mean, yeah, they did, but they didn't, you know, insult her or anything. They just, you know, did.
It would be construed as an insult nowadays. If somebody said what they did, but in those days it was accepted.
Yeah. Well, yeah, back in those days they would say the most like rude things to people and it was just normal. Like people just, you know, it was sort of somewhat flirty, I guess, at times too. And I'm just shocked. There was a scene with the, yeah, I think what you're talking about referring to is like the men that I huddled around and they gossiped like women. It was weird. I was like, wait, did men really, like, I thought even doctors would talk about, like men doctors would talk about something else other than, you know, that a woman doctor is out with another man. Like that's not, you know what I mean? That's not their business, you know, unless it was affecting their business. So
I was surprised that the older doctor who was flirting with you, with her, and then he was very jealous when she met Dr. Edwards. And, you know, he made a lot of sly, kind of snide remarks, you know, about, boy, this is going really fast. And he sent her love notes already. And, you know, and then it talked about the picnic. What'd you have for picnic? You know, on the side of the road, and she said liverwurst, and they all gave each other a kind of a snide look.
Yeah.
But probably some sexual reference. But anyway, they're a little, you know, I remember the 50s and men were like that even then.
It kind of just like made me think, are they her mother? Because they kind of like, criticized how she looked, like her hair was everywhere and she had mustard on her lip or something.
Yes.
And they were like criticizing her, like, why are you looking like that? Like, why? You know?
Well, yeah, you're right. And they did that, I think, specifically that one guy did, the one guy that was in love with her. You could tell he liked her a lot or whatever. He kissed her. Like, you know what I kept saying when I saw that was consent.
But she was real cold about it. She was real stiff.
Yeah. She did not want to be kissed by him. And then he asked something about it and she was like, oh, it was fine, you know, whatever. Because I think at that time she was probably also a little worried about, like, her character was probably a little worried about getting in trouble with, you know, like not letting that person advance on. And that goes to, well, our society has changed so much so that if somebody tried to do that and the person, you know, would say, hey, you know, back away, you know, I'm not interested in you, and that it'll become sexual harassment. They never really had sexual harassment in the workplace back then like they do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was that professionalism. She wanted not distracted by any of the men and their attention. And also she was probably very repressed, which means she's suppressing all of her sexual impulses. And a lot of people go into the psych profession because they're having personal problems, emotional problems themselves. And they become in need of a psychiatrist themselves. In fact, in order to get a job as a psychiatrist, you have to go to a psychiatrist and they have to vet you, that you're normal, that you don't have any strange impulses that you could affect your patients with. And I think she was very afraid to exhibit any kind of, you know, a sexual response to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So she was she was still fairly young, so she wasn't a spinster or anything, but she still had to be very careful. And then she unlocked the door when she met Dr. Edwards. He opened all the doors opening. That was later in the film with him, but her too. So anyway, he kind of brought her out of her self-imposed prison, as it were. So,
well, that guy that liked her talked about that too a little bit. I remember him saying that there was, you know, that she herself was on, you know, hanging out with this guy, and that was good for her because she hadn't really had a guy. She was very repressed, and she was all into her work. She was too focused on her job and not on her personal life. She had no personal life. And, you know, he brought that up. So I think that was interesting, you know, that all that happened. What did you guys think? I want to ask you guys, what did you guys think of the twist at the end of the movie? I know this is like skipping a lot, but we'll get to more stuff later. But the twist with the guy that I did not see it come. I had seen it before and I forgot about it, but I did not see that it was her original boss who was leaving that actually murdered the guy. And, you know, like throughout the whole thing, I was still thinking it might have accidentally been him, you know, that did it. And that scared me to think, like, you know, you might do something and have amnesia and then you forget and you're arrested for something you didn't realize you did.
Well, Hitchcock was at his best. He was, you know, many twists and turns, and you'd think of one person and another person. And then I made a rookie mistake on this one because I grew up watching Leo G. Carroll, who played Dr. Murrenson. And he's always the good guy. He was in Topper. He was the kindly grandfather type of guy. And, you know, I thought, he can do no wrong. It couldn't be him. And he's exactly what it was. And what do you think? Were you fooled away?
Well, a little.
Yeah.
Only because my dad told me a little bit of the doctor in the beginning when they were doing the surgical procedure on the guy who slit his throat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That he was looking at the new director really strangely and like concerned because he was having like episodes of, you know, the lines and the dark lines and the white walls or
flashbacks.
Yeah. So I was kind of like, why is he looking like that? And then my dad says something about it. So I was like, okay, it's a little strange. And then when it was just about to happen, I was like, I know who it is. Like I canceled out all the other suspects and I was like, it has to be the old director. So then it was still surprising that it was him, you know, because we haven't really seen him in the film as much as the other.
I think that's how a lot of mystery things shock you, is they will have the person in only for like maybe 20 or 30 minutes. So you don't expect it to be that person. You expect it to be someone else.
Preconceived notions. You know, when I looked at it the second time, I caught things. He would give kind of a surly, brooding glance. And the first time I missed it because I was looking at the whole thing. The second time I focused on Dr. Murchison, and he was giving clues because he was looking worried or really intense or kind of a dark look. And I'm thinking, oh my God, there it is. You know, he was looking guilty and angry and concerned. And you know, at first I just dismissed that because I was looking at the overall picture. But when you look at it a second time and you have the liberty to focus on one person, you catch it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there, but it's very slight.
Right. And which is good because, you know, nowadays when they do like murder mystery kind of things, they don't let the people know to like the last minute who the murderer is, because the biggest problem right now, and this would be what Hitchcock would have to deal with nowadays if he were directing now, is the fact that we live in an internet age and anybody can go blab on the internet or leak, you know, who the killer is, or, you know what I mean? Things like that. And then there's spoilers already, you know, everybody already knows, you know.
Now
well, this is what, how many years after? I mean, if you haven't seen the movie by now, then that's your problem, you know. You know, you should go see it on YouTube for free, like we did, you know. I don't know, did you guys rent it or did you guys watch it on YouTube?
The link.
Yeah, okay. Yes, that's good, because I didn't see any other way to watch it, you know. So the first time I watched this movie, I rented it or borrowed it or whatever, checked it out from the library. They don't have it anymore.
Oh, wow.
And my guess is either it got scratched up and they can't use it, yeah, or somebody stole it, yeah, and probably sold it, because it is an out of print DVD. So that bums me out, because that's a great movie, you know, and I would never do that, but like, I'm actually, you know, a decent person. A lot of people would, because they make some good money off that shit.
Right. Well, this is a very popular movie, apparently. Maybe some people didn't appreciate it so much, but the Academy Awards sure did. Read some of this, Bonnie. The film was nominated for 6 Academy Awards.
The best music, best picture, best supporting actor, best directing, best visual effects, best
cinematography.
It's a hard word.
Camera work.
Yeah, I know.
So it was up for all of those. It only won for, I think, best music, right? The score. And only because they use that weird musical instrument called a theremin or something. And
it's the theremin?
Theremin used in sci-fi.
You know, yeah. Like, it did have that sci-fi feel to it.
Yeah, but Hitchcock hated it. I found an obscure note about that. Somebody wrote, and he really did hate it, but he used
I don't blame him. Yeah. It's always used in like B-movies.
Yeah.
So like Ed Wood used a theremin for Plan 9 from Outer Space. Yeah,
appropriate to, you know, for some of those flashback things. Mm-hmm. And Salvador Dali did a lot of stuff, but they cut most of it because of sexual influences or whatever, mm-hmm, sexual references. And so that's another thing that he objected.
Loved his dream sequences. I mean, the eyes, you know, and everything, the visual eyes on the wall and everything, like, and then cutting into it. Oh my God. The big, yeah, like scissors. I mean, that was just cool.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, I was really pleased to see Leo G. Carroll in this. He, mm-hmm, was a huge actor. You know, he did a lot of great stuff, and Gregory Peck and the lady Ingrid Bergman played Dr. Peterson. She was I don't know if that was before or after she got pregnant and had a child and everybody hated her. But
I don't think so. I think it's probably before.
Yeah. And then that changed a lot of things, you know, because we're still in kind of a Victorian age. At least the public was, not the actors, because they had an orgy every night practically. But a lot of people hated her for having a baby out of wedlock. So anyway, what are some of the things that you didn't care for, Jonathan?
Honestly, this is gonna sound crazy, but I loved it from like start to finish. I was like, because I hadn't, like I said, I hadn't seen it in forever, and so there wasn't anything like, you know, oh, you know what, I will say this, the one thing I didn't really care for as much, and it's not their fault, you know, it's the time and everything, but what I really did not like is some of the overuse of like really bad visual stuff, like when they're driving and you can see the stuff, you can see that it's like,
yeah,
like it's obviously they're not really driving or something. There's like the, you know,
oh, fake,
oh, the ski was terrible. And
parallel.
I know, they were just going straight down. I was like, they're gonna die. Yeah,
we both, Bonnie and I both ski, so we could tell that was,
yeah,
fake.
Yeah.
backdrops and everything.
And then I was like, wait, so he's skiing down the hill to get his thing back. And what I did like, I like the flash, finally the flashback of like why all of this, you know, and he thought he killed his brother, but it was an accident or whatever. And actually seeing a kid go into a spike or whatever, I was shocked. I was like, even in the 40s, I thought that would never happen. You know, it was shocking. And I actually kind of dug that because of my horror roots and the fact that nowadays you can't do that. You can't. No, sorry, Bonnie. They can't send you down and put you in a spike, you know, just it's because it's protecting the kids from, you know, like there's like some kind of protection with kids now that's more so than it was back then, you know. And back then they could get away with a lot of this stuff. Like in one of his movies, I forgot which one it was, they blew a kid up in a, like the kid had a bomb and he brought it into a bank or whatever. And he didn't know it was, you know, it was the bomb or whatever. And it all blew up. And you didn't see him get blown up. But, you know, like it's that, just that thought and everything. And so you can't do that now. You can't have that kid because parents would fucking freak out and write like these letters. They didn't do that back. I mean, they might have, but they, you know, Hitchcock probably didn't care because, you know, he's like, I'm doing something creative.
They have worse things. I mean, not with kids. If it was an adult, they have body parts flying through the air.
Exactly. This was very PG for, you know, like even the, you know, him falling on the spike, you didn't see any blood or anything. You just saw him on the spike. So it was very PG, but still, like, damn, you know.
I was surprised that he killed his brother because it was, a spike can only go like so deep, right? And then you can get it surgically fixed. Like you won't necessarily die. I mean, it didn't go through the head. It went through the stomach, right?
Well, I mean, he was hit by a lot of force. He was coming down.
Yeah.
So I could visualize that.
When I saw it and saw the way it was, it looked like it went right through his stomach and probably out his back, you know? So it was a nasty death. And I get it because like that would probably make anyone sort of a little insane and think like, even though they didn't actually do it on purpose, you know, you killed your brother, you know? And so it was an accident, you know?
That's when he started locking the doors to his mind. He was compartmentalizing. And so when he merged the two together, this the first event with the second event with the doctor, then that's when he just decided that he would take over the doctor's identity. I mean, it was just an instinctive move on his part. And so that's why he had amnesia, so he wouldn't access those traumatic experiences.
Which was interesting because, like, okay, so you have to think about this. The doctor, Lee G. Carroll or whatever. Leo G. Carroll. He was, you know, first of all, he was leaving, you know, and he was like, oh, the doctor, whatever, is coming. And then, but he knows he killed that guy, right? So he must have known this guy from the very start was not the same guy, right? Like he's not gonna, you know what I mean?
He was afraid he'd spill the beans on him. So some of those looks that I focused on were guilty or worried. You know, if you see it again, focus on him and you'll see him, you know, constantly. He's in a crowd, but he stands out because of these strange look. Everybody else is smiling and he's like really looking agonized or really kind of menacing almost.
Now, Hitchcock did some really cool like tricks with the camera. We talked about it together with online about the milk and the, you know, you see the milk and he's drinking the milk. That was cool. Like that was a great shot. Especially since we sort of know, like, this guy kind of could tell there's something wrong with them. That's why he's getting the milk, and there's got to be something in that milk, and he's drinking it and whatever. And he, you know, later we find out he passed out from the pill. However, the one part, the one I did not like that apparently I read was sort of messed up was the scene with the gun, you know, the gun's pointing and it's following her. When it points at him to shoot, nothing's on the trigger. You know, there was a glitch.
Yeah.
With that. So it happens from time to time, but like, it was a cool visual shot, but I'm like, why didn't he just shoot her? You know, like, I hate to say it. Like, I mean, I want her to live, but like, she's like leaving right now, shoot her in the back, kill her. Then say, I don't know, you know, there's no real proof, you know, that he did it necessarily. There was a little bit, but, yeah, you know.
Yeah. She took a big chance.
Well, I mean, like, even you were telling me, like, throughout the movie, well, throughout the ending, it was like, oh, like, why not just shoot her and get it over with, you know? Uh-huh. But then I was like, I literally said what she was about to say. Like, I was like, well, if he shoots her, they're all going to hear because they're in the building. They're going to run up and then see him there.
Yeah.
With the gun in his hand. And I don't think he's fast enough to leave the building when there's only one exit, unless he jumps off the window. So
nowadays, that's what they would do in a movie, is they jump out the window, make some kind of Spider-Man leap.
His ego was so big that he couldn't live with the fact that he would be a branded man, that he had killed somebody or two.
Why did she tell him all of that stuff?
I know. It's like, too information, too was, honest.
Yeah.
I know, it's not just that. It's just like, you know what? You can just keep, you know, you can keep all that stuff to yourself, right? And then go to the police with it, right? Because like, her saying, okay, so her saying all this stuff and confirming it, right, from the guy does not help later anyway, you know. So if she was wrong, she would just be wrong, you know. She'd just be like, I guess I was wrong. But like, she was absolutely right. She knew the whole thing. She figured it out. And yet she went and just said, you know, this is what you did. This is what you did. This is what you did. And then he's like, wait a minute.
Got him to help her actually confirm it. And then you know, if you're going to do that, the last part should be at the door as you're leaving so she could escape. But she took a big chance on that one, a big risk.
She really did.
I thought for sure he was going to shoot her. But
I'm glad he didn't, but. And because I was happy at the end, and it did have a happy ending, you know, Hollywood ending kind of thing, where the guy's out of jail and now they're happily together. I don't know what that means about her job, you know, like, is she going to stay there or is she going to move somewhere else? I mean, we never really got much more information than that they were happy and in love, you know? So I don't think so. Did we?
No,
I don't think so. So I think at the end, it was just like they were happy and in love.
Yeah. Kind of glossed over it. But I think he just really didn't want to be replaced. Mm. I had no inkling of that when it first started, because it seemed like he was resigned to retiring and moving on. And he didn't give anybody an idea that he was a murderer. But yet, throughout the film, you can see that the looks kind of gave him away. But, you know, if any... I'm really struck with admiration for that psychiatrist, the old teacher. I forgot his name. I wish I would have known. But the actor himself, it was a sterling performance. I was very impressed with him, and I think he should have been nominated for something.
Yeah. Michael Chekhov played Dr. Alexander Brulov. You know,
he should be honored with something for that.
He did a fantastic job, even though, once again, Bonnie, I bet you were shocked at how rude he was to the woman, you know, period. Like, he treated her like an underling, you know, period.
Yeah, he kept saying that women make the best psychoanalysis until they fall in love. And then they make less patients.
Yes. I actually thought that was a good line. That was a funny line. It's just sort of like a rude line, you know? Like,
I had to revisit it and say, what did he say? And then he also said, the mind of a woman in love is operating on the lowest level. Like, wow. It's just slap, slap. But then
he did a lot of that.
Responded by saying, but a mind isn't everything. Love is most important. So she had a comeback on that. But he was so ahead of everything. He didn't. He suspected her lover right away, you know, her boyfriend, you know, as soon as they got there, because he wasn't wearing a wedding ring. He was just doing it. He pointed that out. There were several things he noticed. So he stayed up. He put the stuff in the milk. And then, you know, that reminds anybody in the audience, if a psychologist ever offers you a glass of milk, do not drink it. So, yeah, fair warning.
That's a good, well, you know, was that something you yourself have learned, period? You have you ever dosed anybody with milk?
Yeah, quite often. I have a trail of bodies all over the place. I know most buried. Some of them I kind of forgot, but
oops.
I was always on a ski trip, of course.
Yeah. That's funny. But you know, I mean, because, you know, the milk thing, that's interesting. I never thought about that somebody would just give you milk and there'll be some kind of a pill in it or something, you know, that'll knock your ass out, you know.
Finally, they made a breakthrough. Now, how did they come about that? He actually gave him his name, John Valentine. Remember that? Was that through her or through the older doctor?
That was after everything started coming back to him when he started going down the hill and he figured out that he killed his brother. I think a lot of that started to just come back, like just naturally. The thing with amnesia, and this was interesting because I feel like this is too long for somebody to have amnesia, you know, for that, you know, like I know it sometimes it lasts months, but like I feel like it was gone for way too long. Of his, you know,
I'm not sure how long he'd had it, but what struck me was that how they hurried the pace. Hitchcock hurried the pace of the reveal that he not the doctor they thought he was, and it came right after he got there, and then he was feigning and this and that, and then he was guilty, and he said, "I think I murdered somebody." He was confessing. He was like, "What? Wait a minute, I thought Hitchcock was slower, more gradual, he didn't reveal things quite that quick."
Right, and he really didn't though, because like he was going to say, "Oh my God, I murdered somebody," and then she was like, no, don't say yet, you know, not until we, you know, we figure this out, because you might be wrong, and you know, and he was wrong, he didn't murder, you know.
So he had to fool us again. So until the very end of the movie, we thought, you know, maybe Dr. Edwards is the murderer. And then they found the body, and then they thought, okay, all is well. And then the police said, "Well, yeah, we found the body, but there's a bullet in the back." And that's why they arrested him. So she thought, "Oh my God, I helped convict him. Now he's going to prison because of me." And I tried to, you know, prove he's innocent. And it was just opposite effect. So he switcheroo. There was another switcheroo by Hitchcock. And we're all like going, "What?"
So I'm trying to remember, what was the reason? I mean, it wasn't that he didn't want the guy to take over for him, right? That wasn't his old motive, was it?
I don't know if they explained it.
I'm trying to remember. I think it might, because I remember her talking to
him. Like him. He mentioned something. She kept repeating it in her mind. He says something like, "Well, I met him and I never really liked him." And it was like, "Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah." So he went to meet him at that lodge, right? Or whatever.
Right.
And then the guy was seeing him. The dream brought it all back. But the guy, that weird ass dream, I swear, that was crazy.
Who they thought was the doctor, was brought there because he had a problem with the war. He was injured or something, he had shell shock, he had PTSD, mm-hmm. and he wanted a doctor to treat him. So he was kind of an accidental guess And so the two doctors met together, the real doctors met together. They had some kind of a falling out. And then while the one of the doctors and their patient were skiing down the hill, that's when Dr. Morrison shot him.
So, oh yeah, that's right. No, I agree. Well,
a lot of complexity there, a lot of moving parts.
Now, one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie we forgot to mention earlier, and it has nothing to do with the psychoanalysis stuff, but when she was waiting for him in the in the hotel lobby, you know, to find him or whatever, and that that random guy just sits and starts chatting her up. Oh my God, she was the sweetest person ever for dealing with that obnoxious man. You know, like, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm sure Bonnie, had some guy comes up to you, starts talking to you like that, you would just be like, go away, leave me alone. Yeah, exactly. She was just so sweet. She just let him keep talking to her, you know. She was a lady, but also I think there was a big problem of like she was on the run, you know, and she didn't want to draw attention to herself. So when the house detective comes over and kind of starts asking questions and everything,
he was psychoanalyzing her. And he was thinking he was a psychologist and she was a real psychologist. Lied and said, I'm a teacher or whatever.
Yeah, she was smart about that. She was just lying her way to get him to find out her husband's room number.
Yeah.
Well, which she would have stayed there and waited the whole time if she could have, if she had to, you know, to find him. How did she track him? Did he leave her his information to her in that note? I'm trying to remember.
No, but she didn't have the room number.
Yeah.
And her false name, Jim Brown, John Brown?
Oh, JB. Because she knew the initials, but she didn't know the name yet.
Okay.
So she was describing how he looked, like dark hair, tall, handsome, and had like a small suitcase, and got in this morning, checked in this morning. And so he was like, oh, well, let me go check. And so he was like, oh, these are all the people who checked in this morning, all the men. And then she saw John Brown, so she's like, oh, JB. So,
and the signature matched his signature.
Oh yeah, that too.
Because he just, I guess he assumed his name was John Brown, you know, or whatever, because like those are the only JB names he could think of. But it was like John Ballantyne or whatever. And, you know, it was interesting. He got the first name right. But the second name, he, of course, didn't know.
And first, remember when she analyzed his signature, she compared it to the real signature of the real doctor, and it didn't match.
Yep.
She came over to confront him about that.
She didn't confront him right away. But first, she what she did, she was like, who are you? When he was sleeping, and he was like, what do you mean? Right. Yeah. So, then she was starting to suspect, oh, this is not the real guy. But she wasn't frightened at all. So calm about it.
Oh, you have to understand, this woman actually hangs out with, like, people who are crazy all the time. You know, so there has to be like people who like try to kill themselves or kill other people. She hangs out with them and tries to help them out. So she which I think she felt sort of like excited about this. This was a project for her, as well as it was like she's starting to have feelings, you know. So it was sort of two things like those connected to both of her, you know, feelings or whatever, you know. So I liked it. I hadn't seen it in a while, and I was just shocked how much, like, I still really, really enjoyed it, you know.
Well, I just was worried a little bit about how he rushed the pace about the reveal on you know who he was and how quickly they fell in love.
Like I said, I'm not surprised. Rebecca also and the people fall in love like in a day and get married in a day or whatever. And I'm just like, I'm just like, I think what happens is they don't want to show like days and days and months and weeks, because that takes time out of the thing. So they're just like, let's just have them get married or have them fall in love. Like, nobody will care. Nowadays, people care about that stuff. You can't just do that. You have to show weeks, months, because nobody believes it. You know, back in the 40s, I think people, I don't know, maybe people felt like at that time that could happen, you know, or whatever, you know.
Right. There's an interesting quote in a movie about the greatest harm done to the human race are by poets filling people's heads with delusions about love. So that kind of summarizes what they did. They were deluded into, maybe it was lust more than love, but anyway. But he was her ideal of a man that she'd never been with. And so, but I guess it worked out, hopefully, for them. There was never a sequel.
Well, even when she kissed him, the doors opened.
Right? Yeah, all the doors opened.
Yeah, well, he never made sequels, if you think about it. Hitchcock never did that. Like, that was never a thing for, I mean, back then there were barely any sequels, I don't think, you know. So this was always a one and done story. Yes. I don't even know where they would go if they had a sequel to this. Like, what, you know, like, would they be still together and more guilt complex stuff come up or something? Because that was really what the crux of everything was the guilt complex he had with him killing his brother, you know, and that, like, that one, him seeing the white reminding of him snow, and him seeing the ski stuff, you know. So the lines, which when he first like did that, was she had her she had that little fork, and she was making the lines on the napkin, you know, and he was just like, I can't see that. You knew something was wrong with this guy, you know, like, how can I, you know.
He snapped several times, and he snapped at the table. I said, well, I imagine you have a great deal of money for tablecloths or something like that. Made a very rude remark, and they're all like, what? He said, I apologize. I'm a little road weary or something. But he was quick on the trigger, and he insulted her several times. He just took it.
So. Yeah, she took it. She was sweet. I mean, I don't know why her character was so much of a pushover like that. I adored her more in Notorious, where she had more of, to me, she had more of a character, you know.
Well, where she, by today's standards of women and how we know them today, modern women wouldn't have taken any shit from them at all.
Yeah. Oh no, they would punch or kick and, you know, do all these things, you know, and it would be crazy, you know. So I don't know. I think people are just crazy about that shit, you know, like this day and age, things are a lot different than what it was back in 1946, I think, is when this was 45.
It shot in 44, 45, and it came out in 46. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff about this. Selznick bought the book for $40,000, which is equivalent to about almost $500,000 today. And he used his own psychologist as an advisor on the film. He really wanted to spread this to the world, you know, say, this is the latest, hottest thing, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Sell a movie, you know, I wanted everybody to be aware of it. And, oh, I wanted to talk about Hitchcock's cameo. Did you spot him?
Yes, well, I looked it up beforehand to see when I could spot him and everything.
It was 43 minutes into the film, which is the longest it's ever taken. In fact, he stopped doing that because people were wasting all their time focusing on him and they wouldn't get the message of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't want to distract them. And he did 40 cameos out of 54 films. And I actually looked up and they had a clip of every one of those.
Nice. On like YouTube. That's cute.
Yeah, that was a really cool thing to see that. He's always playing some, carrying a musical case or
smoking. Well, this one, he was just smoking or something. It was strange. Like, I've never even seen him smoke before.
Was it?
Yeah, when I looked at it, it was a briefcase.
Okay. It was a briefcase that he had in his hand?
Yeah, and he was smoking a pipe. Or a cigar.
I think it was a cigarette that he was smoking.
Smoking a pipe and carrying a violin case.
Oh, okay.
So sometimes he did a briefcase. And then he got real subtle with it, you know, like on Lifeboat, he was part of the newspaper.
Well, he didn't want to be like, he originally wanted to be a dead body floating in the thing, but they wouldn't allow him to do that.
Oh God, that's great.
Wouldn't that have been awesome if you were just like, you just saw like the beginning of the movie, just Hitchcock floating in the water?
Yeah, that's him, I'll tell you. He has delicious morbidity, you know, and all his stuff. And I used to enjoy his thing on TV, you know, dun da 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 dun da da, and he'd come in a profile and say all these droll, snide things, and it was so fun.
Well, so, you can tell, like, even though a lot of it's written by other people, you could tell he put his humor in everything. Like, there's a lot of humor in this movie and a lot of snide, like, you know, once again. I think we've talked about this on countless episodes, but, you know, as you've pointed out before, Larry, that that his character, that him himself probably had a distaste for women a little bit, you know, even though he loved his blondes, he loved his, you know, certain looks or whatever. He was very rude and
he was married to his wife, but only the first year when they had a daughter. I think. And so he's very frustrated. But he was always gently or otherwise refused by all his women that he cast. And so he was very angry about that. He was constantly rejected.
He was married, you know, like.
Well, it wasn't just that. He was a little repulsive, I guess, to them because of his weight and stuff.
Well, they still love to work with them.
Because he was pretty famous.
Well, he's very famous and he was very good. He was a very good director. Like he knows how to get what he wants. You know, he knew how to get what he wanted from his actors and from his crew. And that to me is sometimes people will, you know, like forgive, you know, certain things because of how, well, you know, well done.
How she feels about him. I talked to her and she just hated him. He said he was so cruel. He wanted real emotion. So he'd stick the birds after her, the real birds. They were pecking at her head and they're pulling her hair. They could have gouged her eyes out. And he just didn't.
So he didn't care because he thought that was the best way to get, you know, you can't do that today. If I were like, you know, we're going to have to use real birds in this situation, Larry, and we're going to have them come after you, you'd say no. You know, I want my, you know, like, right?
Hopefully I would. I don't know.
You can sometimes sue.
I do crazy things sometimes because they put me in a, I've done my.
Don't let James Balsamo throw real birds at you. Okay. Just say it. We love him to death, but like, you know.
I've never done anything really horrible with him, but I've done throughout my career, I've done some pretty awful things where candy glasses exploded in my face. I've fallen off of cliffs. I've been shot where the squib went in instead of out. If anybody knows what a squib is, it shoots bullets inside of you. Well, it went, should go out, not in. And I was bleeding.
Ow.
A lot of stuff. I can tell you a story on every movie I've ever been in. And I've taken awfully, you know, risky chances. But I don't know if I would have liked birds pecking at me because they're for the kill, you know, these ravens, crows. Yeah.
Well, not my dad's ravens.
Well, I have my own flock.
He has pets.
Yeah, I have a pet flock that come
on
the roof and I feed them.
That's cute. You got to take a picture if you can sometime. That was actually a good thing for Hooked on Hitchcock because, you know, you can see from
way back. I can't find them, but they're out there every day, about 12 of them.
Well, if you can take a picture at some point, you know, send them to us and we'll post them on the message board there, that little Facebook.
Yeah, they're very scary, you know. They're warming up to me, but slowly. I feed them, and then if I get up suddenly, they're all gone. You know, they fly off.
Oh, of course.
They don't like crows. They're because they eat little birds, and they're, you know, they crap over the place, and they do attack people. But so far, they haven't attacked me.
So well, did you have any more notes? Any more things that you wanted to make sure?
That's about it.
Discussed.
I just the fact that he fainted so often, that was part of his trauma.
Hmm.
Can you think of anything, Bonnie? Oh, I love the old teacher when he holds the knife. Bonnie says the butter knife while arguing with the detectives, and so he, you know, they were a little worried about him. Remember when he was protecting his patient?
Oh no, it was a saw, like a tiny saw.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember which one.
Hitchcock loves knives. He always he does a zoom on him, and so he was when they went to see her old teacher. She used to be his assistant.
And yeah,
the detectives were in a waiting room. He hadn't come yet, and they were waiting, and they were talking about, well, if we ever see this Dr. Edwards, like they're in the room, right?
Right.
Really nervous, and then the teacher comes in. And he starts talking to the detectives, and then he gets very animated and kind of, I don't know, for some reason, protective of her and him. And he waves a knife at them, and I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, he's crazier than the patient. So, but a lot of times psychiatrists are a little more vulnerable, sensitive, and absolutely crazier than their patients. And,
yep.
Anyway.
They have to be in order to, you know,
identify with them.
Well, you know, and I've talked to our buddy Mark Valenti and stuff, and I've talked to other people who've, you know, like I know a friend who has a therapist you know, and that therapist talks to their therapist about, you know, about how these patients are driving them crazy, you know.
They're all interconnected. Well, I know when I went on his show, what is it called?
Brain Burrow.
He was surprised at some of the things I'd say, but I'm a little transparent, so it shocks over people. I used to have a psychiatrist, and he'd bring in a psychiatrist just to watch me. He says, this man is very theatrical. That's before I became an actor. And as soon as I became an actor, I didn't need a therapist. So it helps.
So acting is your therapy.
Absolutely. I love
it.
Instead of inventing characters and speaking to the wall and talking to my own voices, I use it for other characters.
I think writing is a little bit of my therapy too, and maybe even podcasting. That's because, you know, I mean, and filmmaking is too, but like filmmaking is a little different because, you know, when I'm in the middle of it, it's almost like something clicks, you know, and I'm like not even completely like the same, you know, person necessarily. Like I'm director mode, you know, like I've switched on like something else. So it's a little bit different. But when I'm writing, I'm kind of in my element, and, you know, maybe I'll be, you know, off in my world in my head, you know, but, so that's a little bit my therapy and stuff. But yeah, I get it. And acting can be a therapy because, you know, it helps you get out those things that you've, you know, gets you all that rage inside, gets that out or whatever.
I have PTSD, so I use it to channel and, you know, my characters. So there, a lot of times I'm chewing the scenery. And people go, God, how do you get all that energy? It was like, I'm trying to vent, and I do rants. Sometimes they even go off script and just rant for 2 minutes. And one movie, the director says, well, you know what? Everybody had their mouth open when I finished, and they went, fuck it, let's use it.
And mm-hmm.
it went right off script and used
perfect.
It was a movie called PTSD.
Oh. How very flattering, you know.
It's a story about a man who survives the Vietnam War, which I did in three
tours. So it was based on a true story.
Yeah, pretty much.
Your life.
I was the veterans counselor. I was the guy that was actually playing the guy that was troubled was another person. He was like a guy, very remarkable actor, but and I was his counselor. But I went off in the middle of a counseling session.
Nice. So
decided to hell with it. We're just going to use what you just said, and we don't care about the script.
Well, sometimes that's the best thing, you know, like because it's real, it's coming. I remember Hitchcock hated actors who went off whatever he wanted them to do. Like he had a very specific vision each, you know, like this is what made Hitchcock really good was he was able to take like his vision and make, you know, and let people know how to do it, you know, and he would share his direction and he would say, okay, Gregory Peck, you're going to walk over here. You're going to talk to this person, that this person's going to come over here. You know what I mean? Like he had a very precise thing.
Very controlled.
But then there was actors like Henry Ford and other people who liked to argue with Hitchcock because they were like, oh, I don't think my character would do that. And, you know, he would be like, well, I need you to do that because that's where the camera is. And if you don't do that, then we're not going to see you, you know, whatever. And so he was very good with that. But anyway, I adored this movie. I thought it was great. And I'm glad you guys liked it too, especially Bonnie, because movies made back then, a lot of kids probably don't, even when I was a kid, I didn't like watching this type of stuff. You know, it was too old for me. And I was, you know, maybe it was maybe 40 years old at the time. You know, so
well, she's very mature. I mean, you know, she's used to dealing with older people since she was a little kid, and so I don't know. So you should speak to this, not me, but.
Well, I mean, yeah, I was raised by an older father.
A very old father.
Not very old, but yeah. So I kind of like the oldies, old music, yeah. And you know,
she's very retro.
Yeah,
you've got an old soul.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. And I appreciate things more than other people my age, so yeah. It's good to, you know, be like that. And yeah, with a lot of other things too, like college and you know, how my future is going to be like. I've always wanted to figure that out since I was in middle school. So yeah, I was pretty prepared.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm glad you're, you know, when I suggested this, I was still a little concerned that it might bore you or something, you know, a little bit but even when I watched it, I was like, this is something I think kids could get into, you know, like kids, you know, it's very not, you know, I mean, other than the little controversial stuff with the you know, the way people spoke, like, once again, that just goes to the times, you know, so.
I mean, I understood it because the stuff I'm learning in English now is way over my head. It's old English and it's very confusing. It's on Emerson and Thoreau, so it's way, way different. But yeah, I understood a lot in the film and I liked it because it was based on a mystery, so
yeah, I like whodunits, you know, kind of thing. And I almost didn't feel like this was a whodunit at first, and then I always thought from the very beginning that this was it was him, you know, we were just gonna have to figure out how he did it, you know, or whatever, or what happened to the body and stuff like that. And you know, but no, there's more to it and it becomes a mystery and it's fun. It's just an enjoyable movie. And I was very happy, you know.
Is that the older doctor did it or the Gregory Peck character?
Oh, I thought he did it. I thought Gregory Peck did it. Like, I thought he did it the whole time. I wasn't even trying to guess that it was the other guy, you know, because had I guessed anybody, I would have guessed it was the obnoxious, you know, doctor who kept trying to kiss her and stuff, you know. Yeah. But
I don't think he knew him, but Anyway, yeah. So Bonnie had a fresh perspective on this because she's carrying the torch for the future from the younger generation.
Exactly. So there you go. Young folks can watch this movie and get it and understand it. It's not very difficult, you know.
Definitely not.
Yeah, more people should tune into Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like, and this is me personally, I've been going down a little rabbit hole of, I've got a thing right now. It's called, I don't know if you'll be able to see it or not, but it's called Everyone's a Critic, 52-week movie challenge. And each week's different, you know? So like this last week was a film with subtitles. So I watched a Truffaut movie, you know, Day for Night. And, you know, things like that, one with animals and, you know, whatever, you know, those kind of things. And so each week I'm trying to broaden my horizons and watch, like I watched a Truffaut movie. I've never seen any. Now I watched one. I watched Deer Hunter. I'd never seen it, you know, but it's a fantastic film, you know, and I'd heard so many great things about it. You know what I mean? So to me, I want to expand my horizons. And I feel like most, especially if you're in the film industry, you should, you know, you shouldn't be closed-minded as to, I only watch these type of movies, you know, because you're never going to learn, you know, about other stuff, you know, and I'm trying to be a little bit more open-minded.
Yeah. I'm always surprised at some young person who knows the history of film and they're a true film historian.
Already at like 12, you know, like people are like that, you know. I know there are filmmakers who start at the age of 12 and they make feature films. Yeah. And I'm just like, congratulations, man. Like, that's good, you know. Spielberg started when he was young, you know, making little shorts. And then he made his first film when he was 16 that we'll never see the light of day, but clips, I think, are online, you know. And I mean, just, you know what? I mean, that's just amazing. And Spielberg is very much like Hitchcock, you know? So there you go. But anyway, thank you. Thank you, Bonnie, so much for coming on this show. And thank you, Larry. We will be back next month for a brand new episode. We'll be watching. I'm going to give you guys the list right now. This is the definitive list. Are you ready for this? Yeah. I'll send it to you. You don't have to write it down or anything. You know, but for 2022 in March, we will just watch Spellbound. April is I Confess, you know, that'll be fun. May is The Wrong Man. So kind of keeping with that theme of the wrong person. June is Frenzy, which I've never seen. I'm interested in seeing that. That's supposed to be like R rated, you know, so I can't wait to see that. July is To Catch a Thief. August is Stage Fright. September is a comedy, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. October is Marnie with your girl Tippi Hedren. November's Under Capricorn, which is a movie that did poorly in the box office, and rightfully so. It's one of his worst films. And December goes to one of his best films, which is Vertigo. So we got a full year, you know, of amazing stuff to watch. So I'm excited. You know, are you excited, Larry?
Absolutely. It's, I always told you, I mean, you're a thrill to work with because you're, I mean, walking encyclopedia.
I'm not that much. I'm just more, I know what I like, you know.
Yeah, well, it's like a college class because I, you know, I take notes, I type them up, I really get into the subject and it's good for my aging brain.
So, yeah, that's good. And then you write down, you got a lot of good stuff. Thank you for all that information about Spellbound that you looked up, you know, and found. So I did research.
Yeah, when I signed on, I was very serious about doing a good job. You can't schluff through this, you know. You have to really focus on it.
Are you saying it's not like Little Stinkers?
We actually did that the same way because I'm a stickler for professionalism. So I all our notes and we practiced and you know, and we're really proud of the work we did. So
yeah. Now, Bonnie, don't you miss it? Don't you miss Little Stinkers? What? Yes?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, well, would you like me to tell Paul that? So, you know, he could talk to you guys more about bringing that back or something.
Better material.
I'll tell him that you guys will come back as long as they are better stinkers than the ones that, you know, they got to be stinkers. They can't be good movies.
Well, it's okay, but give it, you know, like a hidden, at least have something in it that's socially redeeming, you know.
Right. You know, something you guys can talk about, you know, other than, wow, that was terrible.
Yeah.
I got to rewatch your guys' stuff because he made me watch two of the ones that he had you guys do, which was he had me watch in Christmas. He had me watch, was it Santa Claus Meets the Ice Cream Bunny?
Oh, I know. He kept saying that. Yeah. That thing I posted on the Magic Castle while pulling the bunny out of the hat. Is that related to the bunny? No. No.
And no, he likes to bring the ice cream bunny up all as much as he can. And then he made it a minute to watch Fun in Balloon Land. I know, man.
That was terrible.
Yeah,
it was fun to listen to the drunk lady talk the whole time. I mean, I'm pretty sure she was drunk. She sounded very drunk, you know. But
was the balloon one, like the is documentary?
That, is that the parade? Or
yeah,
something?
The parade.
Oh, that was so boring. That was boring.
And he seems to take some demonic glee in all of this.
If you're with him when he's watching and he's laughing his ass off at more of long lines of us suffering than
I know
the movie. But he it was rough. But we actually had more fun with Fun Balloon Land because just listening to this lady's talk about all the balloons, all the different balloons, just cracked us up. We were just like laughing our butt off, like, what is she talking about? What is going on?
I think I remember. I probably fell asleep.
Agony.
You probably fell asleep. I wouldn't be surprised. It was only an hour long or something. There was or less.
Thankfully, yes.
But yeah, we'll have you guys come back, I guess, for that sometime, you know, or whatever, when, because we're looking for some more content to do, and we won't I'll make sure he doesn't torture you as bad, you know, especially if you are willing to come back. I mean, you know, like nothing that will put you to sleep, you know, that'll be my requirement it's got to be able to keep a 16-year-old girl awake, you know. And stuff. So I'll let him know that, and he'll be pleased as punch because, like, he's I think he's been sad that, you know, you guys haven't been doing it.
I haven't heard from him lately, so maybe
he's been busy, you know. But I think you might hear from him a lot more soon because, like, he's gotten things back on track. So, you know, he's doing really good now. But I'm also putting him to work with a bunch of junk. So we've got three episodes of Indie Film Cafe a month to do, you know, that we've been doing. So it'd be like two from me and one from him, and then one from me and two from him, you know. So that's how we've been doing it for this season. And so I've been keeping him busy, you know, with stuff, and he's very happy about us having as much content as possible, including Hooked on Hitchcock, which we're very happy to have back for our second season.
Excellent. Now, how far away are we from your film?
So we're going to be finishing up Scream Queen Campfire in June, I believe. That's the plan. And then in, what is it? I think the October-ish, maybe, you know, depending on people's availabilities and other stuff like that, we're going to be shooting some more stuff out there. But we could always invite you out to do more stuff, you know, like little videos and stuff, acting stuff for your character, because we love the Governor. If you guys haven't seen, the Governor makes his TikTok debut recently, and that was That was fantastic. A lot of fun. Everybody says they love that one.
Yeah, I did too. I don't know where they came from, but channeled something.
I know. Well, we loved, I just gave you some direction and you went with it. So I was happy, you know. I was I was kind of mad that we didn't have a lot of time and we could have done, I wish we could have done more TikToks, you know, and stuff, especially with the governor since we had you here. But we'll have you back. We'll definitely do more TikToks because that's a way to keep the, you know, keep the stuff going in this universe and everything. We'll have to have Bonnie out at some point, have her have a character in this universe, you know. I know you guys work together a lot, so.
Yeah, maybe in the summer or something. Mm-hmm. She's out of school.
Yeah, definitely. When we won't want to try to do that when you're in school, unless it's like on a weekend, and even then, that's like no time, you know. Like, or unless we shot it out in L.A. or something, you know. Which I'm hoping to come visit you guys, like come visit L.A. next New Year's, you know, and stuff. That's my plan. But until then, I don't know when I'll be back to L.A.
Well, we'll be here.
Good. Well, everybody, thank you guys for listening. Tune in next month for I Confess. It's been a while since I've seen that one too, but I do remember seeing it. I do remember loving it. So come check it out. And everybody else, let us know what you guys think. And did you like Spellbound? Have you seen it? We'll leave a link to the movie. So if they need to, you know, check it out on YouTube before this or during this or whatever, they can.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Have a good one. Good. Bye. Ta-ta.